This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/east. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 229. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
How you doing, Roger? I just voted.
Well, goody for you.
Do you do that thing that you can do in California where you just have them mail your ballot to your house automatically?
I know I should have, because I just realized that the voting day is the day I'm actually out in LA shooting.
Yeah, it's just a little over a week off, and so I wanted to make sure I got in the mail tomorrow, make sure it gets there in time, because they don't count it by post date. They put this all over the envelope now. It's not the postmark date. It's when it actually arrives. It has to arrive by the end of day election day, or your vote doesn't count. So I got my voting done. It was hard.
Shouldn't you just do like next day?
Dude, next day error. No, I think if I drop it in the mail tomorrow, it should be fine. Right? Do you think?
I don't know. I've had issues with the mail for the past month and a half, so I'm very paranoid when it comes to the U.S. Postal Service and things arriving in a specified amount of time.
Well, it's a local thing, right? So
it's true. Although what I've noticed is bills tend to show up faster than everything else.
Hmm. Like, maybe I should mark it as a bill.
I think it has something to do with the fact that, like, you know, the water department and utilities are all very large organizations, and people send a lot of mail to them. So the post office has like a redirect for those particular agencies. In the same way, they actually have it for Netflix. They actually have, you know, I think they have a sorting office or a station dedicated to Netflix.
So yeah. Netflix like sort of paid for that. Said, hey, we'll underwrite this. We'll commit to a certain amount of mail traffic. You know, we'll keep you going. Do you think there's all this talk about cutting back mail service on Saturdays in the United States, and there's worries that the mail system is going to go under, you know, because nobody's using mail anymore. Everybody uses email now. Nobody sends letters. But I would bet, and I haven't checked this, that we order more things by mail than we used to because of the internet as well.
I think that's true. And I think it's also the truth of the matter is, if I was going to mail an envelope, say, you know, your standard, you know, one of these in the mail, I would do in the mail. I wouldn't go through UPS or DHL or FedEx because it costs so much. And I think things of that nature, anything that's kind of small, like Netflix, I think works out pretty well. And I think part of it is that the U.S. Postal Service needs to kind of shift and move away from trying to compete with UPS and DHL on this kind of global scale and understand what part of the market they actually can leverage very well.
But
and
that's the dying part of the market, is that small stuff.
Yeah, it is, but I still get lots of junk mail. I still get a lot of junk mail.
Well, and that is interesting, isn't it?
It's a dying service, but I get a ton of it every week. I get flyers, coupons, things I don't use, you know, magazine subscription offers.
Junk mail has not moved over to spam yet.
No.
You think they would?
You wonder, like, do you think the post office would be making some money off that?
Yeah, but they're not making as much. I mean, we get this all the time from people who email a chat room. It's like, let's take one small sliver of the pie and make an argument based on that. Well, yeah, okay, there's plenty of junk mail, but that doesn't mean that they aren't having a much lower load of mail. Well, they can't make all their money on junk mail.
It's true, but if they cut their overhead so they're not competing in the same kind of parcel delivery service that UPS, DHL, FedEx do.
Also, when you consider the amount of mail sent in the United States, if junk mail went down by one letter per week for you, you probably wouldn't notice. You'd still feel like you get plenty of junk mail and it doesn't seem like it's going away. But that one letter a week might account for a 10% reduction across the entire country. and that would be a big chunk of money that's missing out of the post office's budget.
So we should open the floodgates and let junk mailers freely distribute. Actually, they do.
Well, they do. That's what that's kind of the point I'm getting to, which is why hasn't the marketplace pushed junk mail into email? Because the whole thing with the only whole problem with spam is that it's so easy to get into, and you have to have such a small response rate to make it worthwhile. Why haven't more people moved from junk mail to that? Is it because the type of things that send out junk mail don't get a response out of spam, or don't get a big enough response out of spam?
I think part of it is, yes, you also have to understand that not everyone in the country uses the computer in the same way we do. They might check email. They, you know, might do things like, you know, upload photos or get photographs or print out photos.
I mean, that argument is superseded by the fact that spam works.
No, spam does work, but it doesn't mean that junk mail doesn't. See, I think you're under the notion that because spam works, that junk mail automatically doesn't. If junk mail only costs the mailer, like, you know, a nickel on the dollar to send out, but at the same time they get 25 cents.
I'm not saying junk mail doesn't work. I'm saying email is a lot cheaper.
So why wouldn't you
move to that?
Well, maybe it's already occupied.
What do you mean it's already occupied?
Well, it's already occupied by people who already do it much better than you do.
That's a ridiculous argument.
Well, my argument is essentially there's obviously money in it, or else they wouldn't be doing it.
Well, okay, I'll buy that, but I'm trying to get to why is that? I don't think it's because spam is occupied. I think it's because the kind of things that go through junk mail don't get enough response if you sent them by email. And this is probably tying back to something you're saying, which is, not everybody uses email in the same way. Yeah. You need that to subscribe to a magazine. You need that thing in front of you that entices you into it versus getting some sort of Viagra thing where I can send out 2 million. And if I only get a very small percentage response, that's fine. If I only get a small percentage response on a magazine subscription, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, it's not enough.
What constitutes your junk mail typically? It tends to be flyers for local sales. That means supermarkets, your Walgreens, your corner stores, things that have specials, things that people are going to variably walk to drive to.
That's not what I get. That's interesting.
That's the kind of stuff that you get?
Oh, no, I don't get anything local. I get once a week, I get a big bundle with circulars in it that has local stuff, but that's it. The rest of the time, it's credit card offer, insurance offer, frequent flyer mile program, credit card offer, magazine
subscription. I get all that, but I also get a lot of local circulars.
I don't get hardly any local circulars. That's interesting. That's interesting. So that's a regional variation.
Because I'm in an urban environment and you're out in the boonies.
It was the same when I was living in Oakland, though. When I was living in downtown Oakland, I didn't get a whole lot. I maybe got a little more.
You live in
the boonies. I got a few more. Whatever. I got a few more from dentists or insurance agents when I lived in Oakland. I don't seem to get that here as much. Although I get a lot of real estate stuff. I guess that's the local.
It's probably because they have a really good breakdown of the demographics and the type of mail that those demographics will respond to. And so they say, well, obviously this
you
area.
You think it'd be the opposite, though. You think that the chain type landscape of suburbia would lend itself to that kind of marketing, don't you think?
Maybe not. That's why they don't do it.
Well,
or it could just be, you know, not all suburbs are the same, right? Some that have a higher income bracket or a predisposition.
I think you're just weird. I think that's what it is.
They're just weird?
Yeah, you just have a really weird zip code.
Yeah, all right. Okay.
Well, because I'm trying to think. When I lived in the Sunset, I don't remember getting a whole lot of circulars sent then either.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I shop at Safeway and they have my address.
Maybe you got on lists. That would explain it.
That could be it.
Yeah.
They could have sold my information.
Absolutely. And that would explain it. So I just have moved enough times I avoided getting on a list. Oh, you'd think I would get... Because I get plenty of catalogs from people that used to live in the addresses that I've lived at. So you'd think I'd just get somebody else's junk mail, but...
Maybe you're just you know, not considered a viable target for their mass mailings.
Yeah, it's possible, I suppose. I think it's more likely that something like you're talking about, where you got on a list and you're in a zip code, and that zip code proves to be worth it. But overall, I think you're right. I think we kind of circled around to it, which is the kind of businesses, whether they're local businesses or they're credit cards, that send out junk mail these days are the kind of businesses that don't get good response to spam. A credit card is not going to get a good response to spam, because even the most ridiculous person that might actually fall for spam and buy Viagra is not going to sign up for a credit card. That seems to have the one thing that's like, wait a minute. That's how I get identity theft, even if you're not really clear on that stuff, you know?
Well, it's hard. It's I think part, I mean, some of it's just, you know, people are so used to seeing an official looking solicitation for credit cards from a credit card company that you can't really do in a mass email without looking suspect. It's like, Citibank wants to have me as a new credit card customer, but it tells me to click on this link. And what I've heard is you shouldn't click on links to emails that aren't really meant for you, kind of thing. So people are just kind of trained to filter that out. And
I did get plenty of political junk mail. Still coming. Did you get a bunch of that too?
I got actually, interestingly enough, none of it came in the mail. All of it came in my email box.
I got some in my email box too, but I got a few of, you know, Jerry Brown is crazy and wants to eat your children, and Meg Whitman is a rich woman who wants to drive her Humvee through your garden, and all, you know, it's just crazy.
I don't have a garden for her to drive through.
But you know what I mean. Just
and no children for Jerry to eat.
Wild accusations on either side. For those who don't know, Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman are the two candidates for governor here in California. We also have a proposition to legalize pot.
Is it to be legalized or decriminalize?
It is a form of legalization. It says you can carry, what is it, an ounce or less legally. It's still criminal to have a misdemeanor to have a certain amount above, but it makes a certain amount legal. I can grab the proposition.
Proposition 19.
Hold on, let me grab it. I got it right over here.
Okay. No, but it's. I'm all for it, actually. I mean, can't be any worse than what we have now.
What
he thinks?
You're for the legalization of drugs?
Yes, actually, I am.
You think that that we should just allow people to puff up and drive?
I would actually relegate the same prohibitions in terms of operating vehicles that we do with alcohol.
So here we go. Proposition 19 is titled Legalizes Marijuana Under California But Not Federal Law, because, of course, the state can't change federal law, permits local governments to regulate and tax commercial production, distribution, and sale. Legalizes marijuana under California But Not Federal Law allows people 21 or older to possess, cultivate, or transport marijuana for personal use. Permits local governments to tax it. Prohibits people from possessing marijuana on school grounds, using it in public, or smoking it while minors are present. Maintains prohibitions against driving. Limits employers' ability to address marijuana use to situations where job performance is actually impaired. And it could...
Which would be most of it.
The fiscal impact is savings of tens of millions of dollars in enforcement and increase in state and local government tax and fee revenues. So it's a moneymaker.
The thing is, I'm more for legalizing, and although I'm highly suspect about the economic benefits that are often touted when propositions or like this are put forward. You know, yeah, you can tax and you'll make lots of money, and you know, you'll reduce the amount of law enforcement and jail time and all that. It's like, I think you'll see some savings, but to say that suddenly you have a cash cow in your hands is taking it a little too far.
Well, I think you're right. I think you have an overestimation of the fiscal benefit of legalization because people want it to be true, right?
Yeah. The argument is like you can tax it to like 90%, people will pay. It's like, no, people.
That's
will
not go, true of cigarettes or alcohol.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, if you're gonna put something forward, at least try to be you know, a little.
I think it will save money. I think the amount of enforcement going into, you know, looking for illegal pot farms and all of that stuff, you know, you save a little bit of money there. You're still going to have to do drug enforcement, though. So you're not saving tons and tons of money. And you're going to have to spend some money now dealing with the after effects of legalization, which is somebody getting stoned and doing something stupid. So there is a cost raise. I think it is a net savings. The taxation, again, you'll make money. The legalization will make money, but not so many people are going to go buy it now suddenly that you're going to be rolling in it. I think it's... Again, I think it's a nice chunk of money, but it's not a huge windfall.
I think it'll be.
Do you think it'll pass?
I don't know. It's everything I've read seems to be pretty towards it, but again, I don't trust polls. So, really, I mean, in the end, it's how the actual proposition gets voted up or down.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's not going to pass, or if it does pass, it's going to be like many other propositions, tied up in court for years.
I mean, the truth is, in many cases, at least in San Francisco, I mean, the local law enforcement kind of turns a blind eye to small infractions.
Well, it's not just in San Francisco. A lot of Northern California communities tolerate it. It's officially against the law, and they will bust people, but... Yeah, they're not making that a priority.
Yeah, I mean, some counties in Northern California do allow for personal cultivation. However, if you're like growing, you know, an entire warehouse full of this stuff, it's obviously you're not going to smoke it all unless you're Cheech or Chong. So, you know, they crack down on that.
Hey, you know, one way to decide how you feel about this, whether you're in California or not, is to read a book. And this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They sell more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Listeners of this podcast, Audible offers a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. I'm signed up. I get credits. I download audiobooks. I'm reading right now The Once and Future King by T.H. White. It's the unabridged version. It's actually The Sword and the Stone was the pre-edited version. He edited it down later in the 50s. So I get the full experience read by a good author. I've done a lot of driving the past few weeks. There was one day where I had to drive down to Mountain View to give a talk at Google, up to Petaluma to do my show for TNT, and then back down to SFO Airport to fly to Vegas for Blog World. I couldn't. I would have lost my mind without Audible. Thank goodness for Audible.com. They saved my sanity that day. And related to what we're talking about, you can get the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as audiobooks. You can get a subscription. In fact, some plans that you sign up for are absolutely free subscriptions. There's also Ending the War on Drugs, A Solution for America by Dirk Chase Eldridge. He is a conservative Republican who is in favor of the legalization of drugs. A concise review. If you wanted to check it out, you could use your credit on that. Anyway, if you'd like to try out Audible for free, no commitment, get a free audiobook you can keep for life and show your support of East Meets West, you can. audiblepodcast.com/East. So do you know how you're going to vote on the old Prop 19?
Would it be polite for me to say right now?
Would it be polite? No, I don't like to say how I voted. I don't even know why so much. My dad raised me to say it's no one's business how other people voted, and I'm not going to tell you how I voted. That's what my dad would say all the time. And so I was sort of raised in that secret ballot is sacrosanct sort of thing. So if you don't want to say, but believe me, far be it from me to push you. I'm sort of in favor of it. I think it's a good idea to try.
You know, I'm definitely not against it. So take that.
Well, yeah, you're a big old fat libertarian. You don't. Yes. You're an anarchist. Fat. You don't like any laws.
Laws just keep us down.
Laws just keep us down. You know, that is actually one thing that's been bugging me as I listen to a lot of different debates and a lot of different. A lot of different discussions. I see this in the chat room from time to time too. People saying, anytime you bring up government at all, for instance, we were interviewing John Perry Barlow the other day, having a great conversation with him. He's one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the pioneers of libertarianism, founder or chairman, I'm sorry, former chairman of the Republican Party in Wyoming. Wikipedia said he worked on Dick Cheney's campaign for Congress. And he was talking about, with net neutrality, he thinks that what we probably ought to do is have the government not try to regulate net neutrality, but regulate access to the pipes and say that, you know what, everybody needs to open their pipes to access. He considers it an antitrust issue. You trust bust. And basically what he thinks is that ISPs right now are pretty close to developing trusts and they need to be busted open. All these people in the chat room started going, yeah, let the government own everything. The government won't mess that up. I was like, well, this is, first of all, a very Republican libertarian person you're talking about here. I mean, more libertarian than Republican probably, but you know, this is not a guy who believes in the government coming in and solving things, but he's saying in a very limited area here, I think the government's role is this. Have we gotten to a point where if you ever argue that the government has any role in anything, that you're going to get somebody just blowing us, I can't believe anything you say anymore because you think the government has a role in something.
The truth of the matter is the way I was brought up, or at least educated in libertarianism, was the understanding that the whole exercise was essentially not to get rid of government, but to have as small of a government as you could get away with in terms of what you needed to function as a society. And that was essentially erring on the side of small versus big. But it was, you know, it was never in so much that, you know, there should be no government, there should be no central planning, but some sort of regulatory body for certain things. I mean, we do it for utilities in this state. We do it for education. So, if it makes sense in a way that doesn't infringe kind of steps on the toes of people's rights, I'm not against it. And what I think is happening is that people are so entrenched in a political ideology that's been kind of written out for them, either by political parties, political pundits, media, or whatever, that they identify it with so much that any kind of derivation, either left or right, from that from that defined ideology is considered profane and it's like, no, you can never do that. If you say to Republicans, like, well, maybe we should raise taxes, oh, can't do that. Tell a hardcore Democrat, oh, maybe we should consider a loosening regulation, oh, can't do that. I think we've gotten to the point where people are so set in their ways that maybe it's I still believe that we should get rid of political parties. I think it's so detrimental to the way people think about the political process, where they will not budge, they will not comprise, that, you know, even something as simple as what we're discussing right now is considered some huge political, you know, or at least political religious debate, you know, that has no issue or area of comprise.
We got we got a few people in the chat room doing exactly what I was talking about, where they were saying, like, oh, the government should not have total control. That's not what I was suggesting. That's not what John Perry Barlow was suggesting. No one was suggesting the government should come in and buy the ISPs. It was just like, maybe we should have a law that says if you've been, you know, given easements and encouragement to have the legal right to lay wire all around the United States— Maybe, right? And this is the thing. You can't even have a discussion, because as soon as you even raise the question, suddenly you've taken that side. But maybe that's like the highway system. Maybe that's something that we could consider saying, you know what, you have to open that up, and you should be paid for it, and you own it, and you operate it. But all we're saying is you can't be anti-competitive and shut other people out. There may be problems with that, right? But we don't even get there. We don't even get to saying, like, well, how could we make this work? And maybe if we explore this idea, maybe the idea itself as we begin isn't the right idea, but maybe we'll get to the point where we figure out this is the problem with it, this is how we solve that problem. Because people just say, no, that's going to lead to somebody grabbing something and you can't do that and I'm not even going to listen to you anymore. How can you decide anything? You want to talk about why we're gridlocked? We're gridlocked because we got a bunch of extremists who have hijacked the political debate.
I think we discussed this before. You know, I honestly believe that a majority of Americans, actually most people in general, are pretty reasonable in their views and will change them to reflect the situation at hand. As long as it's not like too radical. However, I think, you know, especially when it comes to news as entertainment, it's so much more enjoyable and so much more, you know, ratings grabbing attention to have, you know, people literally spit, you know, invective and insults and, you know, all these diatribes on air, because that's what grabs, you know, eyeballs. That's what grabs sponsorships. That's what makes money for CNN, for Fox, for MSNBC. And so what people get to hear is a lot of the super left, the super right, and everything except the moderates, because that's what sells.
Yeah, and that's why Jon Stewart is having his rally for sanity, which, you know, I think is generally seen by most people as a reaction to the Tea Party and therefore a leftist thing. I would like it not to be. I would like it to be an actual rally for, like, you know what, let's just be sensible about stuff. Heather Gold, by the way, volunteered to call into East Meets West next Sunday and give us her impressions, because she's going to be out there for the, the Rally for Sanity. So if she can find, she's working on a place. She thinks she's found a place where she could call in on Sunday to kind of let us know what it was like out there. That'd be cool.
Cool. I wonder if they have buttons and t-shirts and balloons.
Oh, I'm balloons are awesome. Sure they do. Nobody's going to get by without figuring out how to monetize this.
Well, speaking of government, so I've been reading up on the whole WikiLeaks thing that just got published, I think, yesterday. Where literally hundreds and thousands of U.S. military documents were released to the public, to the wild. Now, do you think in situations like that it's considered a right, even though that material has been ostensibly stolen by essentially an Army officer who was, I think, in Leavenworth right now? But do you think it's stuff like that's necessary to maintain open and free, transparent government in this day and age, where, you know, everyone has, you know, secrets, but everyone also has access to the internets and outlets to distribute information?
The way you phrased the question, maybe unintentionally, was, do you think it's okay to steal? Do you think it's worth it to steal in this instance? Which is sort of makes it difficult to answer, because I do think WikiLeaks has a very important role. I think whistleblowing generally, not just WikiLeaks itself, has a very important role in allowing the public to have information about powerful institutions, be they governments, corporations, people, because that's how we balance things out. How we get dictators and how we get oligarchs is by controlling information and not letting anyone actually have the truth about what's going on. So in principle, I think, yes, absolutely, there is a role for leaking and for whistleblowing. But where it gets tricky is that stuff isn't released for a reason. And that reason could be because somebody's trying to preserve power, or it could be because it's dangerous information to have out in the public. Who gets to decide that? Well, the whistleblowers in this case get to decide, because once the whistleblower has gotten the information to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks has to decide what to do with it. So it's a matter of, do you trust the organization? Because a lot of the criticisms I hear of WikiLeaks is, who are they to decide what gets leaked and what's not? Because they've said, look, we comb through this stuff and try to figure out, is this going to actually put people in harm's way in Afghanistan and Iraq? And we won't leak that part of it. But of course, they're going to leak a lot more stuff out on the web than the military would, or this stuff would be public to begin with. And the military is saying, that's all going to endanger us. I think an interesting sign of balance was struck with the Afghanistan documents that were previously released, because our Secretary of Defense said, we don't think that anything that was released previously has led to anyone being put in danger in Afghanistan. It doesn't mean we don't think it was right. We think it was irresponsible, and we don't think they should do it again. But sigh of relief, nothing bad happened this time.
It's interesting that you're... it's interesting you're bringing up the role of, you know, the responsibility or of the whistleblower, in that they essentially get to decide, you know, in many respects. I mean, it's kind of a power trip to decide, like, yeah, this will go out and this won't. And you know, I've heard a couple of criticisms, and ironically from, you know, organizations like not the torture one, is it Amnesty International or one of those organizations, said they were kind of worried about it because there would be a lot of Afghani translators and stuff and informants who would be put in harm's way because
they're
put in
more harm's way. Somebody in the chat room is like, yeah. Haha, put in danger in Afghanistan. Well, Afghanistan's a dangerous place, but adding to the already normal background level of danger.
Yes. Well, it's one thing to be in the war zone. It's another thing to have people looking for you in a war zone. And so, you know, stuff like that, it's really, really hard to answer. I mean, there are so many sides to it. I don't think there's a clear cut. I mean, everyone's always open for freedom of information, transparency. But at the same time, people don't want, you know, certain aspects of what could be considered to be, you know, dangerous to people's lives, released.
Well, the role of journalism in the past has served that purpose of being an independent estate. It's the fourth estate, right? We have the people, the middle class, and the ruling elite. Those estates have changed. It used to be the church in there too, but right. But the press has supposed to be an independent voice that is professional, that is trained. They don't do that job very well anymore. On the one hand, they tend to more than ever go towards partisan, conflict-oriented stories like we were talking about earlier. On the other hand, they tend to swallow whatever companies and governments tell them with very little challenge. I don't think you'd have a Pentagon Papers situation occur. In fact, I think we're seeing that we aren't having a Pentagon Papers situation occur as we had in the past, because I don't think the New York Times would feel right printing the Pentagon Papers. They would feel it would endanger the relationship with the White House, and so they wouldn't print it. Instead, you have to have a WikiLeaks sort of serve that interim purpose and feed it out to the journalistic entities that they think are most likely to handle it responsibly. But it begs the question, who gets to put WikiLeaks in that position?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's so many. Yeah. Part of it is also because WikiLeaks is so directed, at least the energy, the intent, by its founder, and not in the same way like where you have at least kind of a group or some sort of not judging panel, but some sort of panel to decide what goes in and what goes out. In the same way like you would have for the Nobel Prize and stuff like that, where you have a committee, people sit around and discuss. It's essentially what, you know, what's his name? Can't pronounce his last name for the life of me.
Assange.
From what I understand, is a very type A personality. He's very forceful. He gets what he wants. And so whatever he thinks is correct and whatever he thinks is most appropriate gets done. And so, you know, are people comfortable in having just a single person make those decisions rather than, say, a group of people? Or even a group of peers.
Yeah, and you know, and those are valid questions and valid concerns. The opposite is nobody ever gets to publish a leak. Who is rightfully able to say, you know, I am the right person to publish a leak? In which case, power just continually corrupts itself and has more control to exert over us all. So. You know, there's not an easy answer to say, oh, they shouldn't be doing it, because then we don't have anyone checking power. We don't have anyone watching the watchers, right?
Yeah, totally agree.
So I think it's up to us to look at what gets leaked, how it has an effect, how it's done, what that procedure is, and raise our voices as that happens, rather than just jump to a conclusion and say the whole enterprise should be thrown out to begin with.
Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, if you've got bathwater, check to make sure there's not a baby in it before you throw it out.
Or even two or three.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes they congregate.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for hanging around. East Meets West comes your way every week on the Twit Network Live at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The show is just Roger and I talking about whatever we want. So if you enjoy it, great. We like that. We're as surprised as maybe you are. Sobrilliant.com/EMW is the place to get the podcast subscription and make comments. We didn't get to any comments this week, but we had some good comments from Nick, Final Broadcast, D-Dog, Sean O'Hara, Ramen, all posting up. Well, Ramen only said very interesting episode, which made me think it was possibly spam until I noticed he didn't have any links or anything. So if it was spam, it was bad spam. But maybe you just thought it was a very interesting episode. So thanks, Ramen. And thanks to everybody else. You can read their comments at sobrilliant.com/EMW. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Tom, for having me, and thanks to Leo and the Twit Network for hosting our show.
Thanks to Jammer B for producing it. Thanks to you for watching or listening. We'll see you next week.